slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. Hello lamppost, what you knowing? I come to watch your flowers growing. Ain't you got no rhymes for me? Do it and do-do, feeling groovy. Ba-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready to sleep.
Let the morning
time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you,
oh,
all
life
is groovy.
All your life. No, I mean it, life. No, I mean it, I love you. Life. Hey, come back. Come back. Okay, there's life. Paul Simon. That was for Paul Simon because he just sold his great body of music for less money than Dylan got. Ha ha.
1966.
Huh?
That was from 1966. I was wondering when that was from.
How do you know that?
I just looked it up.
It's what?
I just looked it up when that
You did? You
was.
Did while we were just trying to start the show? You looked up something?
Well, they were feeling groovy.
Do you know what? Do you do... Stop the thing there. That wasn't even funny to begin with, Feldman.
It was...
Cicada, and those are cicadas because we're talking today, hopefully... I haven't seen the reach to them. I probably gave them the wrong email or the wrong day or something like that. I'm just...
Oh, no.
I'm not a producer.
He's in a different time zone.
PJ Leash, he is the Wisconsin bug guy. And it might have been that, you know, an email from Wisconsin bug guy goes straight to spam. You know, bug guy.
That could be.
Yeah, I should check my spam. All right, that was all very good. Let's just go to all the news that isn't.
Is there some news?
It begins thusly. So I'm assuming a character in this opening. It's always a faulty thing for me to do. Yes, hi, I'm looking at doing a little work on my infrastructure, but the quote I got seems a trifle high. So that's a two with how many zeros? I was thinking more three zeros tops. I know it's bread on the water for the economy and all, but I never did get that saying. Throw bread on the water, you get ducks around here. Maybe in your dreams, throw bread on the water and a trout leaps out and catches a crumb and flips into your creel. That'd be in Lynn's dreams. Lynn is here, Lynn Blanker. But he's catch and release, so that'd be more of a nightmare if that happened. Fish jumped into his creel. Are you still with us, Lyle?
You were fading in and out, and then it says my internet connection is unstable.
Oh, then that's your problem. Anything that's unstable about you is your problem.
Can't do anything about it.
I know. Well, make sure you interrupt everything I'm doing. And I'm unstable as well. In other news, Mitch McConnell says Biden's infrastructure plans will get zero, count 'em, no GOP votes. But you can bet Mitch and Elaine will be first in line when the contracts are handed out. There's a little political humor for you if you're your forte. It's not mine, obviously. Nope. Major League Baseball is back to a full season and not ending games where you're winning or got to be somewhere. That was the innovation. Let's play four innings. Yeah, because we're ahead 6-0. Crazy. The only hitch in the giddy-up is due to COVID restrictions, teams will only be able to field 4 of their 10 position players, including the designated hitter. So I'm thinking, and this is just me talking through my mitt, pitcher-catcher, something in the infield, most likely a shortstop, although some second basemen have a lot of range they don't usually get to show. Leaves one more player if they play pitcher's hand out. You don't need a first baseman. So then go with an outfielder in left or left center. It leaves the right side kind of open, but a pitcher who gets off the mound quick should help. Oh, speaking of the Brewers, meanwhile, Brewers fans are up in arms about 25% capacity.
They are?
But heck, Brewers fans have about 25% capacity. And that entire 25% is devoted to trying to say American Family Field, not Miller Park, a county stadium for the geriatric Brewers fans and the few Milwaukee Braves fans left in circulation. County Stadium, there was a ballpark. No big roof deal, you know. Didn't need it.
Those were the days.
Snow on an opening day, you shovel it, you play. Well, the Texas Rangers opened with full capacity in their stadium, 40,000 seats open, and sold 12,000, making the Rangers the best COVID protection Texas has to offer. The All-Star game will remain in Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, in the former Soviet Union. I don't have a vaccine passport, but I do have a vaccine credit card. You get 2% back for every vaccine you get. So far, I've been vaccinated for cholera, dengue fever, diphtheria, Ebola virus, hemophilia, influenza type B, hepatitis A, Bs, and Es, human papillomavirus infection, influenza, Japanese encephalitis, malaria, measles, meningococcal disease, meningococcal. So I guess it has to do with your cockle. Mumps, pneumonococcal disease, pertussis, poliomyelitis, rabies, rotavirus, gastroenteritis, rubella, tetanus, tick-borne encephalitis, tuberculosis, typhoid fever, varicella. I don't know what that is. It sounds like a type of
sounds
ice cream
good.
In Italy. Yellow fever, shingles, Bordetella, and canine distemper. So,
well, that doesn't.
You got 2% for each of those.
2%.
Making
used to be 1%.
More than 100%. Matt Getz said Tucker and him went stag to that prom. Wouldn't say what the theme was. I'm thinking a night in Gomorrah. Add to Getz's crimes, or maybe foremost, he made Al Franken trend. That was unforgivable. After only 57 years, Sarah Palin acknowledges having bizarre symptoms. Well, you know, some never do, so that's fine. Some think there's nothing bizarre at all about their symptoms, or actually are fond of their symptoms. A vaccinated Republican man is harder to find than a good man, and a good vaccinated Republican man, impossible. But I tell you what, they won't sell a Republican man life insurance anymore, so there's that. In this issue of Southern Living, next on tap for Georgia, eradicate the peach. Florida is putting retirees in Disney-themed internment camps. And South Carolina dumps North Carolina. No one's talking to Virginia. This just in, Nepalita, queen of the Amazon, sues Jeff Bezos for trademark infringement. That's long overdue. Don't know if she'd settle for his head or not. She tends to be head first and ask no questions later. And finally, Paul Simon sells his song catalog for $300 million. Had he sold Dylan's, he would have made twice as much. And Garfunkel, of course, gets 10 cents on the dollar. He may be jumping from that bridge on troubled water. That's all the news that isn't. I'm not playing groovy again. How about?
It's too sad.
Art Garfunkel sobbing. I will lay me down like a priest. Art, come on. It's a song.
Why is he sobbing?
It's a song. He's getting 10 cents on the dollar for the song. Art, honestly, you were instrumental in this. Without you standing there next to me, I wouldn't have looked that short. I know, and your hair was... Sail on, golden girl. Come on. We had a good, you know, 10 cents. Well, you know, I'm gonna head right to cicadas, I think, because I feel like I'm not doing too well. Hi, PJ. How are you?
Good. How are you guys?
Good, good, good. Oh, fine. This is one of those mornings where everything goes wrong, even stuff that I wasn't responsible for. Like my machine didn't recognize me, and then it froze, and then Facebook wasn't talking to Zoom. Ugh. Did you ever have a day like that?
You know, a while back, my computer would take about 20 minutes to log on to Zoom. So I had to switch computers and set up another one in my basement. And yeah. Now it's working fine, but that was frustrating for a while.
Are you like teaching over Zoom now and all that?
Yeah, I do give a number of guest lectures this time of the year for various classes on campus. So I've got one coming up next Tuesday, actually, come to think of it.
But, you know, what do you do with insects during a pandemic? Is that do they have to wear masks, every mask?
Social distancing. Sometimes they don't get the cues, though.
Yeah. But, I mean, in your research, you actually can go in the lab or whatever you do in that lab.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, what I do, I run a diagnostic lab to help identify insects or people. Right. I've been working mostly remotely, but I stop in about once a week or twice a week to pick up samples. And then I've got a microscope actually right next to me here that I can look at them under and figure out what they are and let the clients know.
You have one under there right now?
Oh, yeah. I've got one about. It's just off camera right now. I've got a microscope about a foot from
you. Turn your camera just so we can see the microscope. I love visual aids doing this. I try to get.
I'll just take my camera off to see.
There it is. Look at that. And this is at home. You're at home.
Oh yeah, I'm in my basement office right now.
Yeah. Do you ever come up from there? Well, I mean, there's a lot of
every once in a while. You know, need to refill the coffee mug.
How many insects are there in the world? 800 billion or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of species, there's over 1 million documented. You know, folks estimate there's several million more. So the estimates I hear may be 4 or 5-ish million somewhere in there, but it's just an estimate.
Have you found a species? Or do you, I mean, is that the goal of every entomologist to find his own species?
I wouldn't necessarily say a goal, but yeah. It's one of those things that if it happens, like that's really cool. Either find one or, you know, have one named after you. I haven't found one. I've definitely found some interesting ones and noteworthy ones.
By the way, does Lyle look familiar to you at all? Have you seen it before? Maybe at the desk in the office there on the 7th floor when you go into the Larry Mueller show. Because you were the bug guy for Larry Mueller, the latest bug guy. He's had a lot of bug guys over the years.
Yeah. Well, my predecessor, Phil, and I, Phil still likes to do Larry's show. So he and I alternate other episode.
What's Phil's last name?
Pelletieri.
Of course, Phil Pelletieri.
Yeah. You only see the name Pelletieri all around Madison.
Yeah. I know. It's all the construction guys. It's construction and all that. And I think dumping, too. Garbage disposal. They got it. Well, I don't want to say anything. Okay. Cicadas, should we be worried?
Well, no, not worried at all. Yeah. They're in the news, definitely, although so in Wisconsin, we're not going to see this big brood 10 or rumen numeral X that other parts of the country are going to see. Go just a little bit south of us and into the east. Places like Indiana, they're going to be out in force there, but we don't quite see this group here in Wisconsin.
Brood X.
Yeah.
Is it a Roman numeral or is it just actually an X?
It's Roman numerals.
Okay. The brood 10. So what brood are we on here in these parts?
Well, so in Wisconsin, we've got brood 13, which is the one brood that we get here in the southern parts of the state. And that one last came out in 2007. So what that means is...
Are they still out?
Well, no, they come out, they're active for, matter of weeks, and then they die off. The adults aren't very long-lived. But the juveniles are... The juveniles are around. They're down in the soil doing their thing. They're going to be coming out in 2024, so 3 years from now.
If a cicada were trying to justify its existence, what do you think it would say?
It's just trying to do its own thing. I mean, they're just,
That's what we said in the 70s. How did that turn out?
I mean, they basically want food. You know, they have to feed for 17 years to complete their development. And then they come out and, they basically hit adulthood and they want to mate. And
so it's just another day, another dollar for the cicadas. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
All right. What about on the scale of things, the balance of nature and all that? Where do cicadas fit in the balance of nature?
balance of nature. Well, so that's something that when I interact with the public, they often want to know, like, put them insects on the scale. Are they good or bad? And a lot of insects are just kind of, you know, they're just, they're in the middle somewhere. The cicadas, these 17-year ones, they technically feed on tree roots. They drink the sap. They've got a little tube-like, kind of mosquito-like mouth part. Wow. They don't really hurt the trees, though. So, you know, the trees just kind of shrug it off and keep chugging along.
Have you talked to the tree guy? He's on Larry, I think, this week. They're not part of the food chain or anything, right?
Well, they are. I mean, things do eat them. Oh, lots of things will. Various birds, mammals. If you were in an area where they're out in force, all kinds of things will eat them.
Yeah. If that's all there is, maybe, but they don't say, boy, I can't wait for that 13 brood to come out.
Well, right. So they really have kind of, in a way, it's a defense tactic for them. If you were an insect that came out in huge numbers every single year, something that eats you is going to catch on and be like, you know, watching their clock and say, okay, April 15th, food's coming, that sort of thing. But coming out at these long intervals, 13 or 17 years, depending on the brood and species, predators just can't catch on to that. And also they come out in such large numbers. That's a strategy too. A lot of them are going to get eaten, but there's so many billions more that it guarantees that whatever is eating them is going to get full and just can't eat any more of them. So there's going to be plenty to reproduce too.
Is there being so hideously ugly also a defense mechanism? Like, who want to eat this thing?
They definitely have a very unique appearance, especially if you get them up close under the microscope.
Yeah. All right. So I don't know why an insect should have to justify its existence, but I figure if we have to, you know, why not them? It does make you wonder, though. And why a billion? All right. I can see. All right. Let's have a hatching, but a billion is overkill.
Well, it is a lot. And when you think about all these cicadas, so there's actually a whole bunch of different broods of these periodical cicadas, which is why they've been numbered with these Roman numerals to try and keep better track of them. And as I mentioned a minute ago, that's their survival strategy, is they're going to come out in such large numbers that even if, you know, thousands and millions of them are being eaten, there's going to be plenty more to guarantee survival of these insects. That means there's going to be lots that still can mate and lay eggs. And when they do lay eggs, females can lay somewhere in the ballpark of about 500 eggs. So it's really a numbers game to ensure their survival.
Of that billion, how many are females and how many are...
That's a good question. You know, I haven't seen a study on that. I would imagine it's probably fairly similar ratio. That's just a guess. I haven't read that. That's a good question.
And the female differs from the male?
They're really going to look pretty similar to the naked eye. One way, though, when they are out and calling, the males and females make different sounds. The males, and it would depend on the species a bit. There's some cool websites that play the sounds of these. You can listen to audio clips. Yeah. I think.
Let me give you a little test then. One cicada on a drain pipe, and I think it's Philadelphia, gender.
Male.
How do you know?
So the females, they respond, they make a little click, kind of like snapping your fingers.
Oh, that's that thing.
Yeah.
Oh,
so there's a cool video clip with David Attenborough where he does a little segment on these, and he's got a male walking across a twig, and he'll mimic the female by snapping. And so he's sitting there snapping his finger, and the male walks towards his fingers, and then he'll move his hand to the other side and snap, and the thing will turn around and start walking towards the other direction where he had snapped. So he's doing this back and forth and getting the poor male cicada all confused and turning around.
Like
eventually
the
male
West Side Story.
I think the male eventually flies and lands on his face, so it gets fed up with him
eventually.
Good
ending, though. I like the ending. It's like the longest lived insect, but a lot of that is just underground, right?
Oh yeah, yep. The 99-ish% of their life is spent below ground. For 17 years, they emerge, and the adults live, maybe a month. It's really a matter of weeks, maybe 4+ weeks.
But I mean, to be underground for all those years and come up and live for, 30 minutes or something?
Well, a little longer than 30 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it is definitely a really unusual life cycle. Yeah. Evolution can do some weird things in terms of animals and their behavior.
But isn't there a reason for everything in evolution? Or something came this way because this was advantageous or something, and there must have been cicadas who were only underground for a minute or two and then died when they got out.
Well, yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, if you think about what we call our dog day cicadas, these are the ones that we see every summer, you know, in July and August. And they actually, depending on the species, develop below ground for about 2 to 3 years before they come out. But we have overlapping generations of those. So we see those cicadas every year. Yeah. But even with these 17 and 13 year cicadas, I mean, humans have only been really documenting these and trying to categorize them in broods for about 120 years or so. Mm-hmm. And they have found that there's really some flexibility in shifting over time. So at the moment, these broods are generally 17 years, but there's some changes that go on. And actually, the brood 13 that we see here in Wisconsin, there is kind of a subset of that group that we refer to as stragglers, even though they pop out ahead of time, they pop out 4 years early. So last year in Wisconsin, I had some reports of these in like Lake Geneva area, and then Chicago had quite a few of these as well. So that timing does kind of get bumped out of sync sometimes, and it's not set in stone. It does seem to perhaps shift over time.
So are you saying there's an evolutionary reason for those cicadas in Chicago?
In terms of popping out early?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if there's necessarily an evolutionary advantage to that, or is it just, maybe there was a difference in a gene and they pop out 4 years early. And, you know, if one cicada did that, they wouldn't find a mate. It wouldn't get carried on. But if enough of them did that, and that population, you know, grows over time, there could be some shifting in their temporal patterns.
Cicadas probably are not your favorite insect. I mean, did you get favorites when you study bugs?
Yes. As an entomologist, I mean, I have plenty of favorites. I do have some least favorites as well. But I have plenty of favorites.
Give us your least favorite.
So my least favorite, I actually studied these for my graduate work, but June bugs.
June bugs. Never liked those.
Well, So it turns out we actually have not one, but 29 different species in Wisconsin alone that we know of. They all look very similar. They have similar life cycles and so on. But for my graduate work, part of it, I had to do some work at night. So I'm out in this farmer's field in northern Wisconsin. I've got a headlamp on. And poor me, the first year I'm trying to do this, it's May. And headlamp on. So I'm the only light for half a mile. They're just pelting me in the head. Darn near brings me to tears. And so because of that, they're probably my least favorite insect.
Were they attacking you? Do you think they have that sort of?
No, not attacking, just being attracted to the light and you know, flying and that low frequency noise when they fly by, that just makes you kind of shudder.
Sometimes they'd get into our house in Milwaukee. See, we live surrounded by used car lots, light bulbs over the thing.
So
you go out there and they're all over them. They're on every old Pontiac and, you know. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's one of your least favorites. Some of the ones you're unusually fond of.
So as a group, beetles, I love beetles in general, except as I said, you know, not as fond about June bugs or June beetles. But my favorite insect would probably be something called an ice crawler, which we actually don't have here in Wisconsin. Ice crawler. It's a weird group called Grillo Blatodea. Mm-hmm. And if you want to find them, you got to go out west, parts of like California, Idaho, Washington State, and so on. And you really have to get up in the mountains at 6, 8, 10,000 foot elevation. And these things live on the snow. And they're adapted to that. And if you were to find one and actually pick it up and hold it in your hand, it would be too warm. The insect would die from that type of heat. They're evolved for these really cold environments where it's right around freezing.
Can you describe the ice cone? I know we probably don't have one on hand there to show us, but
yeah. So I've never seen one live myself in its natural habitat. I have a colleague on campus who studies them, and he had some for a while in a walk-in freezer. They're somewhat related to earwigs.
Earwigs.
I suppose not a whole lot of folks are huge fans of earwigs out there, but they look a little bit like an earwig, just a slender body, fairly nondescript insect. They're not very colorful because they're out at night, that sort of thing.
So how does their metabolism work?
So there's actually, we have a lot of insects here that can be active on mild winter days where it's maybe between 25 and 35, something like that. So there's a lot of tricks that insects have in terms of adapting their bodies. They can make natural antifreeze compounds and things like that. So it makes sure that ice crystals won't form within their body, and it allows them to stay active. So there's all kinds of evolutionary tricks like that.
All right. Give me another favorite.
I mean, something we have around here, things like antlions, which are actually really common. If you go to a sandy area, antlions, the larvae live down in sand, and they make these little pits. It's just like the Return of the Jedi, that, the Sarlacc or whatever creature it is. You got this pit that it's got this cone-shaped funnel, and the larva lives down at the bottom. And it'll actually take bits of sand and fling it up. So if ants or something else get in there, it's right out of science fiction.
They won't be able to.
Exactly. Yeah, they slide down. And so if you go to sandy areas, you can actually see these around in Wisconsin. They're fairly common as larvae. The adults aren't spotted, not nearly as often, but they're out there too. So that's a really cool one that's around here.
What do they look like? Those little things where you sit on a sand pile somewhere and something's biting you in the behind?
Well, no, not necessarily. If that were happening, I would wonder more about ants biting you. But for these, you really don't see the larvae unless you went digging for them. All you would see is this little cone-shaped pit in the sand. Yeah. And if you watch that carefully, you might see a little bit of movement in the center of that on occasion.
But when the species comes out itself, when the...
Oh, when the adult comes out, they remind me a little bit of a damselfly. Damselflies are like the really skinny looking dragonflies with very slender wings. They'll look a little bit like that as adults for the antlions.
And are they're flying? Huh?
Yes. Yep. They can fly.
I almost lost my job at one point for mentioning this. Speaking of our used car lot in Milwaukee and all the bugs it attracted, it was a famous. Bird shit butterfly incident.
Well, so there's actually, it's probably a moth most likely. And actually,
moth, I think so.
So there's a group called the bird dropping moths, which.
No kidding. See, so I was in the right.
Yeah. I'm trying to see. I've got my moth book right here.
Yeah.
See if I can find some of these just so I can hold it up to the camera.
Oh, this will be great.
Luckily I've got my books right next to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this one, this one is called the small bird dropping moth. There's an exposed bird dropping moth. Moths have some really weird names, but let me see if I can do that. See, you can see these.
The one on the top there.
Oh, yeah.
Look like that.
Yep. Yeah. So there's quite a few moths that have that coloration just for camouflage. Because as you said, they look just like, bird droppings.
Way to say it. You know what I like about your place is that you can submit a bug.
Oh, yeah.
That's so cool.
Yep. Yeah, we as a lab have been around since the late 70s, and it's a service for Wisconsinites. It could be the general public. It could be a farmer. I have an extension appointment, so colleagues in the extension system and county offices and stuff will send me pictures or insects in the mail, but really anyone. If you find an insect or a spider or something related to that, you can get in touch and I help identify it for folks.
If you're out of state, can you actually use our lab too?
Well,
Illinois, right across the border, you're in Zion.
Yeah.
Crazy looking bug. It's got like two heads.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I can make exceptions for out-of-state stuff, especially if it's something really neat. But otherwise, like these days, a lot of my ID requests are actually digital photos, which I can handle. But sometimes, you know, if it's a significant plant pest, there's actually restrictions about moving them across state lines and things like that. So that's why for things like that, it's usually best to handle that within the state that someone's located in.
Now, if you're within the state lines of Wisconsin, and you have a bug, and you think, how does one send one's bug?
Well, if it's an actual physical specimen that someone wants to send in, the best thing to do is you have to make sure to package it up in a little hard-bodied protective container. So empty pill vial, small Tupperware, or, you know, anything along those lines. Back in the day when folks used real film, you know, everyone would have those empty film canisters and stuff worked well. I get lots of folks that simply put their specimen in an envelope, and you can imagine if it's in an envelope, by the time it gets to me, it's little bits and pieces. And
several times.
Yeah. And sometimes I can still figure it out looking at the pieces, and other times I just throw my hands up and say, I can't tell what this is. It's too crushed. It can be more challenging if the folks don't tell me where they're located, because I may look at a photo and say, that's not a Wisconsin insect. You know, where are you located? Because if you think of the U.S. alone, east of the Great Plains and west of the Great Plains tend to be very different in terms of species. Mm-hmm. And then I'll also get, in a given year, I probably get ID requests from about 10 or 12 different countries. And so those can really throw you for a loop. It might be someone in Australia that just found my lab on a Google search. Yeah. And I ask them, like, you know, are you located in Wisconsin? They say, oh no, I'm in the UK or I'm in Australia. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, now I know I should be looking in that spot of the map for possibilities.
Okay. What does extension say about that? What is this long distance to Australia?
Well, I mean, these days with it being, you know, email, that's not an issue. And overall, I maybe get, 15, 20 cases like that a year out of about 2,500 or so.
What did the guy send you from Australia? I bet it was cool.
Well, I didn't get physical specimens from Australia, but I have gotten, in some cases, sometimes similar insects to what we have here. Mm-hmm. If you think about what humans have done with global trade, moving food commodities around like stored grains, you know, some spots on the map will have very similar insects that we do here, and you can actually identify those with photos. So I've gotten some things like that, some really weird moths from Southeast Asia and Australia and places like that. So I do get to live a little bit vicariously through some of those cases.
Yeah. Do you yourself go out on bug hunts? Or
I do when I have time, and this year is different because I now have a 5-month-old at home. But usually during the summer months, I carry along little vials in my pocket because I might be in my backyard or, you know, out in the park, and I see something interesting. I'll pop it in a vial and take it home so I can peek at it under the microscope.
Well, you're a bug guy. You're the bug guy. You're the bug guy. You got to carry vials.
Exactly. Yeah.
You never know what's going to pop up.
Yeah.
I do, like, on the submission form, it says, though, where was the insect found? So that's on there. What was it eating? Come on. We're civilians here in this whole thing.
Well, so what I'm getting at with that particular question, if it was feeding on a plant, because a lot of insects
are... to a corpse or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, that'd be important to know, too. But a lot of plant-feeding insects are picky eaters. They'll only feed on one type of plant. And so if you think about, in Wisconsin, we've got about 20,000 different insects. That's a lot of possibilities.
20,000 different species?
Different species, yeah. But if you tell me it's, you know, a beetle and it was feeding on rose bushes, well, I can, you know, narrow that down to a tiny slice of that. So knowing the plant it was on or feeding on can be really helpful.
Yeah. What beetle likes rose bushes? Pop quiz.
Japanese beetle would be the top one, but there's some other ones out there too, rose chafer and some other ones.
What about naming of insects? Is it fair to call it the Japanese beetle?
It is native to Japan.
Okay, that's fair.
Yep.
And behavior. So you say, where was it found? What was it eating? And its behavior. Also, it's hard to describe bug behavior in the best of times.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there are some really interesting behaviors, though. There are certain flies that maybe will fly in a spiral shape. And so that can be a diagnostic clue. You know, was it just in general, was the insect flying or was it crawling or jumping? Sometimes that can be additional diagnostic clues.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, I get a lot of kind of general curiosity questions. What is this? Because it looks cool or it's doing something cool in my yard. But I also get a lot of questions along the lines of the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Someone sees, you know, this insect feeding on their bean plants in their garden. They want to know what it is and what they can do about it. So I do have a series of links to fact sheets on my website where folks can get additional information.
And what about, you know, farmers and about gardeners, serious gardeners who are looking for natural ways, natural solutions in the garden to some of their problems and looking for beneficial insects to encourage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and overall, insects, when a lot of times folks think about insects, they have a negative impression that they're only pests and things like that. But really, in terms of the species that we have, most of them are going to be beneficial one way or another. Mm-hmm. So there definitely are some things you can do in your own yard, like simply having a greater diversity of plants and different types of flowers and stuff to encourage the good guys to come around, and they can help control pests in your garden sometimes.
Yeah. What about large scale for farmers? If they want to stop using lasso or whatever, you know?
Yeah. So you can really kind of scale up what folks can do in their backyard to larger agricultural systems. We know from some research studies that the more diversity you have in the landscape, that's going to help you out. If you have, you know, if you looked at Wisconsin from a top down, if the area is nothing but corn and corn and corn and corn and more corn, that's low diversity. We're not going to have as many beneficial predatory parasitic insects around versus if you had more of a patchwork of different types of crops, and then maybe you have conservation strips between fields with prairie flowers or something like that. We know from some research that can help increase the number of beneficial insects in the area.
When you were a kid, did you want to be a entomologist?
Well, good question. So I didn't know specifically an entomologist, but I grew up in farm country in southeastern Wisconsin. We had a pond in our yard, so I was always trying to catch frogs and salamanders and fireflies and stuff like that. So I did know that I really had an interest in animals and biology in general, and I remember catching, you know, lots of fireflies and stuff like that as a kid. But it was probably when I got into high school that I really fell in love with entomology.
And it's a pleasure talking with you. I don't feel I lived up to Larry Mueller's ability to zero in on certain aspects, but on the other hand, he wouldn't have said bird shit butterfly. Thanks very much, PJ.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Ask not what she can do for you. You're in her country.
You're in her country.